Hello, this is Debbie from Health Communications, and welcome to our audio tape book series. The following presentation by John Bradshaw is based on the best-selling book, Bradshaw and the Family, A Revolutionary Way to Self-Discovery. It was recorded in a studio in April of 1989.
I want to begin by talking about the family as a system, and I know that lots of you have heard some of this material. It's very important to underscore that family systems work is only 35, 38 years old. It's a brand new phenomenon. The biologist Bertalanffy began to talk about everything in the world being organized in the form of a system, what he called general systems theory, that the whole universe is composed of systems and subsystems. If you think of your own reality. I have a nervous system and a circulatory system. There's all these systems within my body, and yet you could never really have a relationship with me just by understanding those subsystems. Those subsystems all come together in a system called John Bradshaw, and in whatever your system is. Then I'm also part of a family system, and that family system is part of a cultural system. It's part of a religious system. It's part of a country system, part of a universe system, and then we have a solar system. So we can go macrocosmic or microcosmic, and we always find system. And what Bertalanffy wanted to show was that there are laws that govern systems. And of course, the immediate relevance to that is that there are laws that govern families. If we begin to understand those laws, we can begin to understand some of the things that have impacted our lives. Like I call my book A Revolutionary Way of Self-Discovery. Because I am convinced that unless you know the system from which you came, and you know what the dynamics were in that system. See, and that's why comparisons don't work. Even if we're all adult children from alcoholic families, there are going to be differences. Ackerman is showing in his research a lot of the differences that come out of, even in alcoholic families, the differences that impact a female in an alcoholic family and a male in an alcoholic family. Why all the kids in the family don't come out the same way, even in an alcoholic family. So we have to be careful not to generalize too much. But it's real important that we understand that families are social systems, and that as a social system, a family has laws, and it has rules. It has rules, and it has components, and it has principles or laws, we might say. Well, really, that's what the rules are. They're the laws. And then it has roles. It has roles that dominate in it. A lot of this work was done by dealing with people who were isolated from their systems. Palo Alto, Virginia Satir, and Gregory Bateson, and a number of those people began to realize that if we treat this person, we can do a lot with them until they get back in their system. And then they would find that they would have this great progress in treatment until the girl went back to her family, and then she would just go right back into the same stuff. Or, if they kept her out of the family, somebody else in the family would get sick. It was like suddenly they began to realize this system needs a sick person in it. And so a lot of times the kids that become the scapegoats, the service bearers, and see, that's a lot of us people who have been so dysfunctional, who've become addicts, are one of the things that's happening out of the family series that has been the most enjoyable thing for me, the most heartwarming thing for me, is the number of penitentiaries that are watching the family series. And I have literally thousands of letters from convicts who have discovered that they've been in the rebel scapegoat role, that they are acting out on society out of loyalty to their family systems. And you ought to see some of the letters. I mean, I have wept reading the letters from some of these prisoners. And I am told, like at Huntsville in Texas, the privilege is to get to watch the series on a Saturday night. I mean, this is unbelievable. Do you know what they told me when I started, when I presented this series? That nobody will see it. It's too heavy. This stuff's too heavy. Nobody's going to watch an hour of television. You can't hold people's attention for an hour on television. And see, I knew that this material had blown me away. I mean, I had been a therapist for 18 years or 15 years when I got into this material. And suddenly I sat there one day in Shreveport, Louisiana, listening to a guy present just a very simple Sharon Wechsler Cruise, the five family roles in an alcohol. And I'm going, my God, there's my brother, there's my sister, there's me, there's my mother. And it was like after all these years of doing therapy, it just put everything together for me. For example, for years I could never understand some of the issues around my brother and how my brother and I seemed to be so different. Yet we both were addicts, we both had some similar kinds of problems. But he would do things that to me were just, just terrifying. And yet we were from the same family, we're acting out the same family pathology. So it was very helpful because he was very perplexing to me in his behavior. And suddenly it made sense out of his behavior that he was a lost child, that he had been probably violated more than anybody with the youngest child. You see, often the youngest child gets it the worst because the dysfunction is accelerating by the time you come along. By the time you get there, they're really in dysfunction. And often you weren't planned, so the lost child role, remember, is the role that says, get lost, kid. We really don't want another kid. And so you can get that message in the womb that I'm not really wanted. So in any case, I knew that this material had blown me away, and I tend to just, Carl Rogers once said, whatever is most personal is most general. And I found that over and over again, telling my secrets, going to meetings and telling things that I've never told anybody. And then, everybody's picking their nose while you're telling them. I'm going, what? I thought this would blow you away, I thought you would be shocked when you heard this. People were over there scratching and, it's like, no, that's nothing, Bubba, And so that, and when we start getting those secrets out, there's a healing. That's one of the rules we have to break. Because in dysfunctional families, there's that no-talk rule. So once we start talking about our stuff, I was talking to a guy the other day, and he's been in compulsive masturbation for probably 35 years. And he was just talking about, I sort of did a Milton Erickson with him. I said, well, maybe it's okay for you, to masturbate four times a day. I don't. And he said, no, it's pathology, and I said, well, okay, then, we got these SAA meetings all over the place. There's hundreds of people in there that have beat this problem. Oh, I couldn't tell anybody this. See, that I couldn't tell anybody this, that secret. And so we got to start telling our secrets, because whatever is most personal is most general. And the more that we're willing to share, the more do we connect with a common humanity in each other. And that when you get all isolated and in secret, you start thinking and exaggerating yourself out of all proportion. But anyway, so the idea is that in these social systems, people will play roles because one of the laws of family systems is homeostasis, balance. So on the television series, I use that beautiful mobile that Trudy Sween made for us. And I was just talking to Beth Miller yesterday because Beth Miller and Charlie Miller helped sponsor that series, and she thinks she's going to buy that mobile because it's something that, now, like people will say, will you bring the mobile when you do the talk? It's a 6-foot stainless steel mobile. But anyway, it's a wonderful way to illustrate a family system that when you touch one part of the mobile, every part of it is affected. So that in a system, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Now, if you don't believe that, think of last Christmas when you went home and the whole family was there. Okay, I see some of you shaking your head. Well, what I mean by that is, like, I have a relationship with my brother. My brother and I play golf together, and we have this wonderful relationship. I have this relationship with my sister that's a kind of a special relationship. I can take my mother out to eat, and that's kind of a special relationship. When you get us all four together, something else happens. And that's the system coming on. And stuff will happen. You'll start acting. They don't quite know why you're acting this way. or last summer we had my whole family together, and I have two stepchildren and one natural child. We've, in a sense, never been together, and it was pretty tense at times. But it's sort of that whole system now is together. And when you have blended families, wow, there's a whole bunch of other dynamics that go on. Because they're coming from other systems. And so you've got systems all blending together. But anyway, the law of homeostasis says the system will always try to balance itself. So these people in the penitentiary, these rebel scapegoats, are often acting out the rage from their families. The rage that wasn't being expressed. See, everything has to be expressed in the system. We say there are no secrets in families. We did the Geraldo program a few weeks ago, or a month ago, and I was able to bring all the people on there. We did it on incest. And incest is an area where in severe dysfunction, family dysfunction, wrapped around a secret. But what we say is there are no secrets in families. That, like the child of an incest victim who's untreated will have a 5 times greater chance of being molested. Incest is multi-generational. So is alcoholism. Some of that's genetic. So is obesity. Some of that's genetic, but not all of it's genetic. Murder in families tends to be multi-generational. Financial failure is multi-generational. It's astonishing once we begin to realize that this stuff will be carried in these systems until we get conscious of it. And the most damaging stuff in a system is what is covert, not what is overt. Like in my family, my daddy was an alcoholic. Well, it was obvious. You know, the problem was obvious. You know, when your dad's sleeping on the porch at 2 in the morning and mother says it's for his back, you will tend to go along with it for a while. You know, dad's got a bad back. That's why he sleeps on the porch at 2 every morning. The kids will go, oh, okay, you know. But after a little while, you begin to get on to it, that isn't what it's about. Well, it was so blatant in my dad's side of the family, the alcoholism. My grandmother was alcoholic. There were several generations of alcohol. On the other side, though, they were like Ozzie and Harriet. And it didn't look like there was any dysfunction over there. But believe me, there was dysfunction over there. See, and it's like, for those of you who come from families that look good, like in my book, The White Family, where Mickey White is an elder in the church and owns his own company and is a multimillionaire, as sick a family as any other family that I described dysfunctionally in that book. Workaholic, womanizing, the kids all in treatment. But it looks perfect. They're in the best schools in Houston. They're elders in the church. Those are the kind, if you come from those kind of families, it's often harder to understand. It's more crazy-making. Like a workaholic family, it's more crazy-making. The kids say, where's daddy? Well, he works for you. And that's why you have all those clothes and you have a car and a bicycle. Daddy didn't do that. So, oh my God, you go off in the corner. How could I even think of wondering where my dad was? You're being abandoned, of course. You're like an orphan. You're hurting. You feel that you're worth less than his time, which is shaming, which is sort of a being kind of shaming. But, you know, it's like, why was I, you know, that's awful for me to ask that. And so you see, in that kind of family that often looks good because it has all the symbols of success, the dysfunction can be much more covert and much more damaging. So I want you to hear that. I don't stress that enough. And I didn't stress that enough in the series or the book, but I want you to hear that. So one of the laws of social system is balance. If the family doesn't have the anger being expressed, one of the kids will act it out. If there's a lot of secret sexuality going on in the family, one of the kids may become very promiscuous, like sexual addiction. In fact, I'll be willing to suggest if your family's got any secrets, it's going to be around sex. If there are any secrets left, the place you can count on them is they'll be around sex. Because what? That's sort of the most shamed place in the society. And people are going to have secrets around sex in areas that they're not going to have. You know, it's kind of become fashionable to be an alcoholic or a drug, you know, recovering drug addict. But you don't want to be called a sex addict. I mean, that's, ugh. you know, I understand where Bill W. and Dr. Bob were, why they made it anonymous in the beginning, because sexual addiction just hasn't reached the same kind of proportion. But let's say a womanizing, first-level, compulsive, sexual acting out of a father can dysfunction a family as much as an alcoholic in the family can. Because there's deep conflict going on in the marriage. The kids are being affected by that at some level. So you see, this idea of the family as a system means that everybody is interdependent on everybody. And that when we come to look at a family, we've got to look at the relationship of dad to himself and dad to mom and mom to herself and mom and dad to the children and the children to themselves and the children to each other. That it's the interrelationships that make up the system. Now, in healthy families, the system is vibrant. It's like the mobile is always in steady motion in a healthy family. The rules in a healthy family will be flexible rules. Like I wrote down, you know, what I would think of as healthy family rules. Mutual respect. A social equality in the family. That each person is respected. See, one of my theses is, in my book and in my television series, is that we have a set of rules for child rearing that are 200 years out of date. They come from the time of kings and monarchs. That somehow the French and the American Revolution have not impacted these rules. And my thesis is that the end of these rules was Nazi Germany, Nuremberg and Auschwitz and Dachau. That if you want to know the potential of these rules, look at Dachau and Auschwitz. That's the potential. That's what Eric Erickson said so brilliantly in Childhood and Society. That the black miracle of Nazism, so planned and so superbly bungled, is still a potential in the West. Because the rules. And all you have to do is watch one of these highfalutin radio TV evangelists if you want to see what this obedience to authority and the trance that people get in that kind of obedience to authority. Where by the time they come up to be saved, they're in a trance. And there's so many codependent adult children out there in those audiences, you know, who just don't even have a choice. And that's terrifying and frightening to me. And then when we see these national TV evangelist figures acting out their own sexual addictions, because you see, it isn't just having a prostitute in Louisiana, it's seducing whole congregations. That the sexual addiction is around. It's being seductive, and that's why we're seeing so many ministers who are sexually addicted, sexually compulsive. And it's coming out. Recently, a guy on the state board in Florida of child pornography was caught as the head of a pornography ring, a minister. Child pornography ring. And I studied to be a Catholic priest, and I saw a lot of stuff in the monastery that it took me about 15 years to start talking about. But it wasn't all sweetness and light, let's put it that way. So once in a functional family, the system is open, the mobile's in gentle motion, the rules are flexible, all feelings, needs, and drives are acknowledged and acceptable. Any feeling is acceptable. Now, acting on the feeling may not be acceptable. See, there's a real confusion about anger. Real confusion about anger. Children, human beings have a right to have anger. Anger is an important emotional strength. It's a biological program that we have, which does what for us? Protects us. Hey, stop it. Give me my wallet. But stop. Oh, whoa. Boundary. Boundary. If you don't have anger, you don't have a boundary. How many of you have said yes many, many times in your life when you wanted to say no? Not express your anger. Let people walk all over you. So you become a doormat and a people pleaser. A nice guy and a sweetheart without your anger. Because I grew up in a system that said anger is just horrible. And in the terrible twos, what every child needs to learn is that I can be angry at you and you'll still be there. If you have a mother that's dealing with abandonment issues, so that when you get angry at her, she withdraws her love from you, what you learn is that if I get angry, you will withdraw your love from me. So a lot of us grew up terrified that if we ever expressed anger, the other person would go away forever. Some of you are shaking your heads. probably this is the more common pattern in our culture, that people do not have healthy ways to express anger. Now, what's a healthy way to express anger? It's to say, I'm upset about this, I want to talk about it, I don't like what's going on here, I don't have to yell when I say that. If I get it right when it's happening, healthy anger is an emotion, it's an energy. Healthy anger is not beating someone up. That's a behavior that's based on a judgment. That's not an emotion. Burning your room down is not an emotion. Cursing someone out is not an emotion. Raging at somebody is not an emotion. The emotion of anger is a healthy emotion. Most of us got shamed in our anger, and shame plus anger equals rage. So, you know, I shared last night, in my own family, I was a rager for years and have been having some rage slips lately. I'm a recovering rage addict. And done real well in my recovery up until about the last year. And I've been having some slips with it. And I dislike it. It's offender behavior. But what I do is I rage when I don't know what else to do. I have bad boundaries. And like when I'm pressured or I feel frightened or I'm too anxious, rage is a way to try to have control. And for people who don't learn boundaries well, often we resort to rage because we don't know what to do. And so anyway, having healthy emotions, it's okay to feel what you feel. It's okay to feel what you feel. And I want to tell you that's the most important rule that any family needs to have. And it's okay to express what you feel. Now, how many of you, when you said, I'm afraid, had somebody say, no, you're not? Or what are you afraid of? There's nothing to be afraid of. But that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. What? Now, that's so silly to be afraid. Well, see, what's happening then is you're getting your fear shamed. Fear plus shame equals terror. Paranoia. Low-grade paranoia comes from having your fear shamed all the time. See how that happens? Because fear is wisdom. When you have healthy fear, you have wisdom. There's a lot of things to be afraid of. And if you don't have any fear, you know, the guy screwing his next door neighbor's wife is out of touch with his fear. Right? He's going to get his head blown off. Or going over canyons in tricycles, you know, that. Going over 23 buses at Caesar's Palace and you miss by 4 inches and you say, put another bus there. Ever seen a 4-inch bus? You know, so fear is healthy. Man, it is great to have. Someday we will be through with all. Real men can't show fear. See, we'll have some guy wimping around and we'll say, God, that's great. What a man. That Joe, what a wimp he is, you know. Because, you know, men need to be liberated too. And to be a man and never be allowed to have your fear is real scary kind of thing. And I know I was a family hero. See, and heroes are never supposed to be afraid. And it's very hard for my family to know how needy I am at times. Because I look like a star and a hero. And run around teaching everybody else, you know, how to do it. So it's hard for people who are close to me to know that, you know, there are times when I'm a scared little boy and I just need somebody to put their arm around me or just be there for me. And all of us do. There's no one alive that doesn't need that. So in healthy families, you can have your fear, you can have your sadness, you can have your anger, you can have your joy. My family couldn't have joy for more than a minute and 37 seconds. If we were getting too happy, rambunctious was the word. They'd say, well, now I think it's time to go to bed. We've had enough fun. Now, how many of you, when you're starting to have fun, you stop yourself? Say, oh, God, there's something wrong with feeling this good. This must be a sin. I shouldn't feel this good. I better stop myself. But we've had enough fun for one night. And I'm sure I'll pay for this in the long run, for being this happy. See, it really is a strange thing that we were born to be happy. We were really born to be happy and to be joyful. Just watch little kids, and you'll see what the natural state of us is. Enjoyment, curiosity, wonder, what Carl Jung called the wonder child, the wonderful child. I'm working on a new book now called Homecoming, Reclaiming and Championing Your Wonderful Inner Child.
the child is full of wonder. I mean, this is a place of wonder right here in Santa Fe. I mean, to wander around here, and there's something magical about this place. I can see why people gravitate here. And there's a sense of the wonder. It's wonderful. You know, there were days, O tender elf, when you were poetry itself, where you were the born comrade of bird, beast, and tree, and unselfconscious as the bee. You were a late explorer of each sense, without dismay, without pretense. In your transparent eyes, there was no conscience, no surprise. Life's queer conundrums, you accept your strange divinity still kept. See, we were all that way once. How do people become murderers out of that? And child molesters, and crooked politicians, and dictators, and violent people. I mean, that's the sin, and that's the tragedy. And that happens in families. That the training for that is in families. And that's why for the health of this planet, we've got to care about the quality of life, the quality of our inner life in our families, and see that in functional families, all what Virginia Satir called the freedoms, to see and hear what you see and hear, not what you're supposed to see and hear, feel what you feel, not what you're supposed to feel. See those perfectionistic systems that shame us, which are cover-ups for shame. You shouldn't feel that way. What do you mean? What's the matter, mother, as tears roll down her eyes? Nothing. Go to your room. Little kid gets weird. Little wonder kid starts going away. I thought, well, I could have sworn she was crying. You know, could have sworn I was tired. Could have sworn I was lonely. Could have sworn I was scared. But you see in those systems. So all the freedom to want what you want, not what you're supposed to want. The freedom to think what you think, not what you're supposed to think.
Where'd you get an idea like that? You leave this table right now. We don't think like that in this family.
Religious boy, you say, you know, I don't think I believe that stuff Father told this morning. Your wonderful little curious mind challenging it. Somebody exiles you. And so suddenly you have to give up your own reality. You have to give up your own authentic self and start conforming. And that's what Carl Jung called the persona. It's what Eric Byrne called the script, the false self, the act, your melodrama, your role. We call them roles you get into in the family. See, and these roles are ways to matter. We get into these roles as ways to matter. Children want two things. They want to believe their parents are okay, and they want to matter. And we will do anything to matter. We will do anything to have significance. We will play these roles to matter and have significance. So you see, how can I know that I'm who I am if I can't feel my feelings, if I can't think my thoughts, if I can't want what I want, if I can't imagine my imagines, if I can't see and hear what I see and hear? So in healthy families, you get to do that. In healthy families, conflict is expected, acknowledged, and negotiated. In some families I know, they've been having the same fight for 47 years. See, and again, what every kid needs to learn at 2 years old is we can have a fight and we can resolve it. My family, we never learned that. My brother and I have a fight, we don't talk for 4 months. Any of you can identify with that? We don't know how to resolve anything. Nobody ever taught us how to resolve things. Healthy families, conflict is expected. We're all unique and unrepeatable, so two unrepeatables meet. We're going to have conflict. Conflict is expected. If you have a healthy, functional family, there's going to be fights in it. What healthy families have is fight fair rules. They know how to fight fair. Individuality and differences are acknowledged, respected, and when possible, encouraged. That's an interesting idea. That religion that you founded, Farquhar, you know, he's 6 years old. Come to look at a dysfunctional family, what happens is the system starts closing. And the system will close around whatever the dysfunctioner is. That could be daddy's alcoholism. It could be mama's hypochondriasis. Mama's sick all the time. Mama's in bed all the time. It could be mental illness, something that I've neglected to talk about a lot, how that can dysfunctional a family.
It can be disability. It can be poverty. It can be incest. It can be violence. It can be an eating disorder. It can be somebody who out of their shame is controlling, obsessive compulsive, demanding that everybody do it their way. I mean, you can just simply have a father who's obsessive, compulsive, and controlling, or a mother who's obsessive, compulsive, and controlling, and dysfunction a family. Because everybody has to adapt to that which is controlling them. And this is how people become codependent. Dysfunctional families are dominated by codependency. Everybody becomes codependent on the mental illness, codependent on the alcoholism, codependent on the incest, codependent on the secrets. I know of a family where the grandfather's mother and father both killed themselves. He never told his daughter one word about that. So they're still carrying these secrets around suicide. That can dysfunction a family. The secrets, the shame secrets. I've tried to describe this in Healing the Shame That Binds You, how this stuff is multi-generational because of the shame secrets. So what happens as a family becomes dysfunctional, now I want to make a point here, no family is completely dysfunctional. All families are functioning in some way, or they wouldn't be alive. So while I say all families are dysfunctional to some degree, all families are also functional to some degree. And that's important. Last night we were doing a talk at the theater and the lights go out. Well, that's old home week for me. Because what I learned to do in my alcoholic family is survive. I love it when there's crisis. Can y'all identify with that? I mean, crisis, oh my God. Boom, 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 boom. And that's why a lot of us have become addicted to excitement. You know, and it's why a lot of times in your relationships, you know, the gal says, well, I just always go, I don't know what's the matter with me. Every guy I go out with beats me up. And I said, well, where do you go to meet guys? Biker's bars. You know, and I said, and you've got this bumper sticker that says, have you been laid lately? You know, I heard Terry Garsky describing this. I'm taking that from Terry. But it, you know, and he said, you know, Terry told the gal, he said, well, maybe there's a selection error here. And the woman said, well, where do you want me to go meet people at churches? Now, what I want you to hear in that is that often, and I've done this a lot in my life, we confuse excitement for intimacy. And really, what we do is confuse excitement with fear. It's almost like that excitement is what you saw your addicted parent have with their drugs. That the relationship, if the only relationship you've known is this relationship of an addicted parent with their drug, or their addiction to each other. So excitement, addiction to excitement. Anyway, as that dysfunctioner happens, that system closes more and more. And the more it tries to change, the more it stays the same. And then the rigidity starts. See, mental health is characterized by flexibility. The more choices you have, the freer you are. If it's my way or the highway, see, rigor mortis, that is, you're limited and your freedom becomes, like I think of Shakespeare, you know, oh God, that man should put an enemy in his mouth, my own drinking days, that we should with joy, pleasure, revel, and applause transform ourselves into beasts. I sat in stinking taverns for hours, day after day, drinking alcohol. I mean, that's not a lot of choices. You know, just sit there and drink one beer after another, one drink after another, for hours on end, how your life has become shrunken, how your freedom has gone away. And that's true of any addiction. The issue with addiction is that it's a problem of the will, that the will has lost its choices, and that life has become shrunken down into the idol alcohol, or the idol sex, or the idol money, or the idol food, or the idol starving, or whatever the idol is. They're all idolatries. They're all about worshiping a god, but it's a god who's killing you. They're abortive religions. So dysfunctional families are characterized by addiction, by rigidity, by rigid rules. In dysfunctional families, you can't make a mistake. You get creamed if you make a mistake. You get ridiculed. You get humiliated. In dysfunctional families, the rules are rigid. You can't have certain feelings in this family. If you have them, we will cream you. And so very early on, children start giving up their reality and start in order to matter. Like in my family system, there was dysfunction very early on. My dad was an alcoholic. They married at 17 and 18. My sister comes along. She's a lost child, basically. These two kids aren't ready to be married. So the role, Barbara became perfect. Nobody ever heard anything out of her. She became perfect. That's what lost kids do. It's sort of, please let me stay here. I will have significance if I don't bother anybody. Now, later on, we'll talk about how working on that role and how to get out of that role. And I talk about that in my book as the original pain work of giving up these roles, because these roles are where you gave up your authentic self in order to matter. I became a star and a hero and a super achiever, straight A student, captain of the baseball team. See, star, everything I did was excellent. But I became a human doing instead of a human being. Everything had to be an achievement. See, I didn't have any worth. I didn't matter unless I achieved, unless I made straight A's, unless I was a star on the baseball team. And so you see, my role is like to come into a room. I don't know how to just be part of the group. That's what I've been working on for 7 or 8 years. Going in groups where nobody knows me and just being part of the group. Learning how to be part of a group. Learning how to be significant and matter just as part of the group. Not having to be the leader. Because it's lonely being the leader. And the star and hero is just as dysfunctional as anybody else. But that's the one that's tough, because you don't think of the stars or the heroes or the caretakers. This is another role. If I take care of you, then I'll matter to you. If I take care of you, if I give you all the sex you want and I give you this wonderful life and I'm just there for you, and you never, then maybe I'll matter to you. See, and so these roles are ways of mattering. But they're dysfunctional because they're roles. It's an act. It's an act. It's pharisaism, which means hypocrite. In Greek, that means an actor. A hypocrite's an actor. False self. And for some of us, began to get in touch with my true self until I was 42 years old. Didn't know I was in an act. Because once you start getting into these rigid roles like lost child, hero, scapegoat, my brother became the scapegoat, he would run away and the family would all stay close together. It was a way that we didn't have to look at our non-intimacy and we could all talk about him. And so the kid that's in most trouble will be the scapegoat, who is almost always the most sensitive person. My brother is the most sensitive person in our family. The most sensitive one will take on all the family pain like the scapegoat and go out in the desert. So the rules become rigid and often covert. In dysfunctional families, the rules are often not even talked about. But you get it that men have all the power around here and that women are inferior because you watch the way your mother acts around your dad. See, a lot of women start getting the message very early on, there's something wrong with your sex. Or there's something, your sex is not as good as his sex. Now, nobody ever says that. It's not on the icebox. You know, they don't put that on the icebox door. But believe me, the message is loud and clear. There are rules about what feelings you can have and what feelings you can't have. Now, they're not written out either. These are like rules when you went to college or you went to school and, you know, the teacher walked in the classroom and said, any one person in this room who doesn't get an assignment in on time will fail this course. Oh, God, this is going to be a terrible course. Then you go to the cafeteria and you're talking to some people a year ahead of you. You said, boy, that Bradshaw, he must be a terrible teacher. You miss one paper and you fail. They say, oh, that's a crock. I didn't get 14 papers in last year, and I passed. See, so you start getting what the real rules are. It's like, what's the speed limit in any state? It says 55, but that ain't the speed limit in Texas. And everybody's got radars in their car, see? And everybody's going about 68. That's the real speed limit is either 64 or 68, depending on the state. But it's not what those signs say. So in dysfunctional families, the rules are very covert. The role, think about allergies as a dominant kind of dysfunctional family. We can think about incest families, eating disorder families. These are the kinds of families I described in the series and the book. Workaholic families, any kind of addiction is going to seriously dysfunction a family. And it's really important that we understand that. And the more secret the addiction, like sexual addictions, the more that covertly will be affecting the family. You know, because there's secrets going on. Like I worked with a gal, and this gal had been to at least 7 psychiatrists that I know about. Nobody had ever gotten to what the secret was. After 18 years, off and on, I saw the family 4 or 5 times over 18 years. The mother finally came in one day and told me all the secrets. That the grandfather had been an acting out sex addict, that he had 500 pornographic videotapes, that she and her husband used to watch porno flicks every night, that the husband had had intercourse with her pretending like it was the daughter, and the daughter was the one that was in all the trouble. And the woman would play out the role of the daughter in the same family. See, now the daughter never knew any of this, but did she? See, in family systems theory, she knew all about this. It was impacting her life enormously. Father was a very wealthy man, quite a successful businessman, would never come into therapy, still to this day has never come into therapy. Control, rigid controlling, but carrying this sexual secret. See, for rigid controlling people, the only way you can be out of control is in your addiction. So almost always control and rigidity, which are cover up for shame, will lead to addiction in some other area of your life. But that'll be the secret area. So I talk about the orange family, the eating disorder family, where there's this authoritarian, dominating, born-again father, millionaire. Mother is a Eastern school graduate. Hates the guys, wanted to leave him from about the 6 months they've been married. This is 18 years later. When I see the family that the 63-pound anorexic daughter has brought into me, who is the scapegoat, who is carrying all the pain in the system, all the rage in the system, who is just like her father, Spartan, controlling and rigid. She's a wonderful runner, but she's dying. Who for whom a feeling equals eating, because the feelings are so painful in his family and none of them are being dealt with. And some of you read about that in the book. I described this whole family, the dynamics in this family. And then by the time, what I did in that therapy is worked on the mother's anger. When we began to get the mother's anger out, the daughter started getting well. I'm happy to say that this daughter is fully functioning human being right now. She was dying. But we didn't treat her, we treated the mother, and we treated the marriage. Because, in family system, the marriage is what's important. Look, you have a workaholic father, he's in love with his work. You have a mother who is dominated by the father's work and is enabling the father's work and is obsessed on the father because he's never there for her. He's obsessed on his work, she's obsessed on him. Who's there for the children? So you can't come from an addicted family and not be not emotionally, oh, this is good English. You will be emotionally abandoned. Daddy's an alcoholic. He's in love with alcohol. Mother is obsessing on daddy. Who's going to be there for the children? You will be emotionally abandoned. You can't come out of one of these families and not be shamed. Shame means there's no time for me. I'm worth less than the time. What happens then in these families is that the children have to start taking care of the parents' marriage. The children have to give up their own reality, and this is the tragedy of codependency, which is really having a shame-based self, that I can't be me, so I have to be somebody else. See, a codependent is a person who doesn't know who they are. The disease of codependency is a disease of false selfhood. I don't know who I are. I don't know what I feel. I know what you feel. I don't know what I want. I don't know what I want. I sort of fall into wants. I sort of accidentally go through life and react rather than act, rather than choose. Right now, I'm choosing things for the first time in my life in the last 5 years. I'm making choices about my life for the very first time. For the very first time, my life is not a multi-generational accident. I mean, it's awesome when you think about it. That for the very first time in my life, it's not a multi-generational accident. And that I'm making choices. I don't know what I feel. I don't know what I need. I don't know what I want, because all my needs got shamed. All my feelings got shamed. You see, if you have a mom and a dad, I love this Bob Subby drawing where, you know, he draws a figure, and then inside the figure, there's another figure. That's a picture of an adult child. There's an adult here, but there's also a child in there who never got their needs met. Well, what happens when one of these meets another one of these and they get married? See, here are two people who look like adult, talk like adult, but there's two little starving kids inside who both have holes in their soul. They meet, they fall in love, and they whop, they enmesh. Now we're one, and then there's all kind of support for that. Two in one. One half times one half, my better half, equals a fourth, by the way. And that's exactly what happens. But they start having a family. So here comes little Farquhar. And often little Farquhar comes because this little girl says to this guy, you can be the daddy I never had. Now that doesn't come out in courtship, by the way. This only comes out after you're married. 2 weeks after you're married at the breakfast table is when this comes out. And this little guy over here and this adult says, oh boy, she can be the nurturing mother I never had. Because in courtship, you were nurturing each other. There was this symbiotic bonding. And you were just, you know, being wonderful for each other. Because you go back to primary codependency, the healthy codependency, the symbiosis. And if you didn't have that, if you were narcissistically deprived, you didn't have that, you're going to be real in danger of being a love addict. Falling in love with love and just loving the sensation of being in love. And, oh, it just blow away. It's like drug and addiction and trance, and you're out of your gourd. And the sex is oceanic. It's you go back into the cosmic dust and the Big Bang. It's wonderful. I'd do it every week if I could. And you know, the new person, everything about them is just the way it should be. You just see everything. You're in the now. And you focus on their nose and their ears and their smell and their voice, and my God, if we could really live life like that, it would be fantastic. But the second you get married, boom, these two little kids come out. Then all that courtship was a suck-in. Because it looked like this person was going to nurture you like you really needed to be nurtured. See, so in my book and in the series, we talk about you got to heal this inner child, or else they'll be looking for a mother and daddy for the rest of their life. And a lot of the work we do in healing, how do we heal these dysfunctional families? A lot of the work is grief work. It's grief for these kids who get it that they can never be kids again. I can't set any of you guys up as my daddy. I can't set any of you women up as my mother. That's what I try to do all my life, beginning with Holy Mother Church. When I studied to be a priest, gave up my sexuality and embraced Holy Mother Church. You see, and that was going to take care of all my needs and get me salvation. If I gave up my sexuality, I'd be a little less than the angels. I don't know why the hell anybody wants to be a little less than the angels, but you get that? So you go through your life looking for a parent. There are four patterns that happen when you come out of dysfunction. One is you'll enter into addictive relationships. You will keep choosing a person that has the negative and the positive traits of the parent that you're most wounded with, in the hopes that this time you can work it out. Then what else you will do is you will distort what's going on in order to set up the original situation. What Alice Miller calls the logic of absurdity. We'll keep reenacting it in order to try to get it done. Until we heal these children in us, these inner kids that got wounded in these families, when you took on these roles and you gave up your authentic self, until we heal that, we will go through life reenacting the family scenario. So it's like having never left home. You die never knowing who you are. And people do that. That's the greatest tragedy I know. Willie Loman, The Death of a Salesman, is a drama, a great Aristotelian drama that celebrated not the Oedipus, the king hero, but the Loman, Willie Loman, who died never knowing who he was. Now that's the greatest tragedy. What else could there be that you die and you never knew who you were? You can't have a greater tragedy. And every addict, as we eat the pills or drink the booze or go for the sex or go for the mood alteration, we're trying to get back to that authentic self. We're trying to find salvation so that our addictions are a metaphor of our deep spiritual bankruptcy. Because once you lose yourself, you're spiritually bankrupt. You're spiritually bankrupt. This is what Bill W. and Dr. Bob understood. There's no recovery from addiction until you had a spiritual awakening. What Nietzsche understood, until you get back to your healthy shame, which is the safeguard of your spirituality. Because how can I be spiritual if I don't know who I am? See, there's what I call shame-based religion all over the place. What it is you just act out being righteous. They tell you how to be righteous and you pretend. They tell you how to be loving, so you pretend that you're loving. You have a smile. You have a loving smile. You become a joy addict. There's a lot of religious addiction that's dominated by joy addiction. So they're always smiling at you. You know, you died, your dad died. Oh, that's wonderful. Aren't you lucky that God loves you so much?
Yeah.
And you're in all this crap in your life? That's wonderful. Those people, they scare me. I want to get them out of there. Get me away from this person. They're running around telling you how much God must love you because all this crap has happened to you. So see, it's another way to be a false self. It's just another way. And I mean, I acted that role out for years as a seminarian, studying to be a priest. I was a little priestlet with a collar on. I talked priestlet language. I knew how to talk like a seminarian and play the role to the hilt. And I catch myself constantly still doing it. I mean, I will act like I think you imagine me to act. I am self-image actualized rather than self-actualized, if that makes sense. It's like I'm always making this scene of how I'm going to be rather than just being the way I am. See, in a healthy family, they look at the way you are and they orchestrate that so that you can become who you are. In an unhealthy family, you have to become who they want you to be. You have to give up yourself and you have to take on one of these roles. So in the recovery process, there's got to be a healing. Because these two adult children can't possibly raise this child. It's two, you know, 180-pound four-year-old and 130-pound four-year-old raising a 40-pound four-year-old. You can imagine what's going to happen. And I said this, I've said this a lot. You see, here are two adult children. They're both needy. When this kid is needy by nature, not by choice. So we talk about your developmental dependency needs. What happens when this kid gets needy? These two kids get angry. These two parents get angry. And I will bet you that if you're from a dysfunctional family, the time you got abandoned the most is when you were the most needy. When you most needed someone to love you, you got abandoned. And that's one of the tragedies of being in a dysfunctional family. So in the healing process, we've got to go back and make the abandonment real. Fritz Perl said, nothing changes till it becomes what it is. I call this the recovery process in my book. That you've got to find a network. See, one of the great things that's happening in this country now is people are coming from all over. And we're all taking our masks off and we're saying, yeah, I can identify with that. See, I think there's a great fortuitousness in the term codependency. It's a lot better than a borderline personality, isn't it? Wouldn't you rather be codependent than a borderline personality, for God's sake? Or a paranoid schizophrenic, or a schizoid, or a depressive personality. I'd much rather be codependent. I don't know. There's just something about it that it has a more euphemistic sound. So I think the great fortuitousness of codependency is that people are just coming out of the woodwork and say, yeah, I can identify with that. And boy, I can identify with those traits, you know, from dysfunctional families that's okay. And so we're coming out of hiding. We're talking to each other and we're sharing our experience, strengths, and hope together. That's the first step in recovery, is coming out of hiding. Because if you're from a dysfunctional family, you're carrying all that shame. And shame goes for secrecy and hiding. The only way out of the shame is to embrace the shame. The only way out of the shame is to embrace the shame. I've got to come out of hiding. So I call that the recovery process. Finding a friend you can talk to, or a 12-step group, or a therapy group, or a non-shaming church or synagogue group, or whatever. Then the second step is doing this original pain work. Going back into that family system and finding out what happened to you, making it real. Now, it's not a blame game. We're not blaming parents. We're just saying they were backing out of the driveway and they ran over you. They didn't mean to. Hey, they didn't mean to. They did the best they knew how to do. So do you get it that intention is not relevant? We don't care what the intention was. You got run over. And you've been limping for 41 years. And you need to know what to do to heal the limp. And what you do is you make it real. And you get in touch with the pain about it. And you get to the anger about it. You don't go to your parents with that because they didn't do it intentionally. But you get a batonga stick and beat a chair, or you get in a psychodrama, or you go to Sharon Wertscheider Cruz Family Reconstruction, or you go to Gestalt, or you do a New Life Family Workshop, or you do something that helps you get back into to re-experience the original feelings. It's called original pain work. And I call it the uncovering process, the uncovering what happened to you. Nothing changes till it becomes real. This is grief work. You cannot grieve alone. You need somebody that legitimizes and validates your pain. That's what I did on the family series. I did it nationally. I said to all the adult children, your abuse is real, and it's okay to talk about it. And see, there's a healing that comes with that. That if I can say, I'm not crazy, it's more about what happened to me than it is about me. Any kid from a dysfunctional family is a post-traumatic stress victim. And we act like post-traumatic stress victims. So, the grieving process is the way I finish the past and I quit looking for fathers and mothers. It's painful. And it's sad that I didn't have a childhood. And lots of you didn't have a childhood, but it's over with. Once I've done that, then there's an ego reconstruction. And then I can begin the discovery process, which is really discovering my true self, higher consciousness. Now going into meditation, getting in touch with that still, quiet voice. That face you had before you were born. What the Zen masters say. Show me the face that I had and the identity I had before I was born. Your true self, the wonder child, getting back in touch with that wonder child. Those are the things that we're looking for. So recovery, uncovery, discovery is the process. So I'm going to stop there.